Cantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Erebus by Ralph Kern, narrated by Sean Grindell. Human progress is neither automatic nor inevitable. Every step toward the goal of justice requires sacrifice, suffering, and struggle. The tireless exertions and passionate concern of dedicated individuals. Martin Luther King, Jr. Prologue.
Just what the hell is that?
Jerry Mitchell knew the first sign of madness may well have been talking to himself, but he considered it a prerogative of being a Deep Space Service tender pilot to be a little crazy. After all, who else would want to spend weeks in a ship with as much volume as your average bathroom? Seeing things, though, now that was a stage too far, even for him. He pulled himself into a seat in the cramped cockpit of the Longhorn and played with the controls on the main view screen, trying to get what he'd glimpsed into sharp focus.
"Damn it," he grunted.
The Longhorn had moved relative to the tiny rock, and the thing had swept out of view, rotating to the other side of the potato-shaped asteroid moon.
"Okay, not a problem."
He reached over his shoulder and felt for the harness strap, finding it floating behind him. He clicked the fitting into place. Wrapping his mitten-clad fingers around the joystick, he yawed the tiny craft around, hearing the bangs of the thrusters. Through the cockpit window, the bloated world of Akaga swept across his view, the vast gas giant's rings set at an angle from his position. Steadily, Eva, a captured asteroid-turned-moon, appeared in the center of his screen.
"There you are. Okay. Let's go take a look."
Jerry fired a positioning laser at the rock and squinted at the stream of numbers on his heads-up display. The HUD showed relative velocity, distance, and revolutions of the rock. Yeah, he could make the rendezvous easily enough. The main reason he had come so close to the rock was that someone back at Twilight Garden had figured that the asteroid with a cargo in the background would make a good photo opportunity. Now, he'd just get a little closer than expected. He rubbed his mittened hands together, excited to be doing something, and off schedule, too. It was a rare experience in the tightly controlled world of deep space exploration. The Longhorn began thrusting slowly toward Eva. With one eye watching the numbers, Jerry grunted in satisfaction as they reached the expected values, which showed that he was on track.
"Here, I think."
The Longhorn had settled in, following in the asteroid moon's orbital track as it endlessly circled Akaga. Jerry fired the forward engine, bringing the ship to a halt relative to Eva. Now he just had to wait a few minutes for the rock to rotate. Leaning back in his seat, he began drumming his fingers, squinting at the monitor image from his small telescope. Then he saw it on the horizon of Eva. A tall building. A tower, maybe? No, more like one of those oriental buildings.
What did they call them?
Pagodas. Jerry gave a long, low whistle. A pagoda on an asteroid orbiting a gas giant that circled Sirius. A star 8 light-years from Sol. An asteroid that no one had ever visited before. The flight deck recording of the Longhorn's mission to Akaga turned off. The men and women seated around the conference table, some of the most powerful people in the Sol system, looked at each other with the piercing, glowing eyes of the enhanced.
"Fascinating,"
Patrice said finally. She had been gripped by the recording, but her face took on a troubled expression, and not just because she, the voice of the Linked, had voluntarily vaulted herself from the rest of her people for this meeting.
"However, the timestamp indicates this is from 2156. I have to ask, has this just come to your attention, or have you been sitting on this for the last 46 years?
The host turned from the window, where he stood looking over the darkening skyline of superscrapers, and regarded her with his electric blue eyes, before letting them wash across the boardroom. The fact that these people were here, by his request, testified to his own political power. But like all such things, he could lose that power in a heartbeat. And being implicated in one of the greatest conspiracies in history, that could easily prove his undoing.
"Yes," voiced Patrice. "I knew about this only 8 years after it was discovered. The earliest I could know about it."
The volume of the murmuring around the table rose. Patrice's voice rose above the others.
"Keeping quiet the discovery of the first technological alien artifact is a gross violation of the Outer Space Treaty, something you can spend a long time in jail for."
The man held his hands out, and the noise subsided.
"I've cashed in on many favors to get you into this room. I need you to hear the whole story before you start talking about arresting me."
"You have asked me to keep this meeting private from the link," Patrice snapped. "I am going to struggle, in good conscience, to do so."
The host settled into his chair and looked at her earnestly.
"Let me finish my story, voice. Then, by all means, you and everyone in this room can do with the information what you will."
Patrice leaned back and looked at him calmly.
"As you say, you've cashed in many favors to get us into this room. We will hear you out, but you do know this cannot be kept secret."
"Thank you, and I know."
The host nodded at her in gratitude.
"For you to understand everything I'm going to tell you, I need to give you context.
I'm sending you another file. It is the recording from one Leighton Trent's HUD. Some of you may know him as being one of the investigators of the Io incident of 2183.
"The Io incident? What has that to do with this artifact?"
one of the men at the table asked, confusion in his tone.
"As I say, my friend, context."
And if you didn't like the violation of the Outer Space Treaty, the host thought, you're going to hate this next part. Part 1. 2183 CE. Chapter 1. 2183 CE. Sahelia. The Karen Cole Hospital.
Murder is easy. It's just the pull of a trigger, the thrust of a knife, or the push of a button. Yes, murder is definitely easy. It's the getting away with it that's hard. It's my job to make sure bad people don't get away with it.
I knelt down in the dust next to the charred remains of the body, the stench of burnt flesh in my nostrils. The bandits in this area couldn't take on a combat-enhanced UN peacekeeper in a straight fight, so they'd become creative. A wire net had been thrown over Corporal Tenby, connected up to a power source they'd salvaged from some old vehicle, and they'd let it fry his armor. Then they'd cooked him, literally, with gasoline and home-brewed thermite. He would have had long minutes to realize what was happening. Sometimes it was a curse how well modern combat armor could protect you. Death hadn't been the end of it either. Not by a long shot. They'd butchered Tenby. His implants had been crudely carved out of his body and his weapons stolen. His teammate had suffered a similar fate. The final two members of his squad had been taken out in their sleep in their sparse quarters. Hopefully, that was quicker than what had happened to Tenby.
"You okay, Dev?"
I asked, squinting up to where my partner stood over me. Jacques Devereaux was a veteran police officer, like me, but he was newly attached to war crimes and the brutality and callous horrors of these kinds of places. Dev rubbed his designer's stubble, coating his chin, which had, in the last day, grown out a bit more than was fashionable.
Yes, it's just different to home, you know.
I know. It was indeed. This was Dev's first field deployment for The Hague. It didn't get much more different from the cosmopolitan streets of Paris than this.
Come on, we've got a job to do.
I stood up from the sandy floor and dusted my knees clean, squinting from the brightness of the oppressive African sun. I looked over at the gutted shell of what would have been loosely called, in its heyday, a hospital. Our liaison came out of the hospital, picking her way through the still smoldering, blackened rib-like spars of the single-story building, calling orders at her troops before walking over to me. Her armor's active camouflage blended with the background, adapting as she moved. The effect was surreal, like watching a disembodied head balanced on a figure-shaped heat shimmer.
"They're inside?"
I asked, knowing the answer already, but needing it confirmed.
"Yes, Inspector Trent. Everyone is accounted for. 7 staff, 4 patients, and the UN troops, of course."
Captain Ava Phillips's voice had an Australian twang, the kind that made you think of beaches and surfing. She deactivated her camouflage, revealing pristine dark battle armor. I nodded and gave the ruined corpse at my feet a final look. The soldier had died a long way from home, in a land that people were calling more and more to be left to its own devices. I activated my link, requesting my boss, Captain Giselle Allard, back at The Hague. I saw her face appear on the heart of my eye implants.
"Morning, Giselle,"
I said. I couldn't keep the edge from my voice.
"It's confirmed. We've got 15 here. Their kit and implants have gone, too. If it's not all on the black market yet, it soon will be."
"Christ, Layton. How the hell did they get the drop on these guys?"
the neatly suited officer asked, her silky French accent not quite masking the cool anger of her tone. Behind her, I could see The Hague office walls.
"I'll send you the pics. It was an ambush. Looks like they disabled the troops' armor with some kind of contraption they jury-rigged together. I'm guessing they got the idea from the Hypernet. Then they torched them."
"Okay," she winced. "What do you need?"
"We'll start with the basics. Do we have a forensic team in this neck of the woods?"
"Stand by."
She went quiet on me, looking down at something out of my view.
"The closest we've got is back here, and they have a pretty full workload. Would you be happy with some local talent? I hear Cairo has some pretty decent folks."
I mulled it over for a second, trying to dredge up from memory whether I'd seen them in action. I couldn't recall if I had.
"Could they take something like this on?"
"Yeah, they're good. I'll make sure I get you someone who's qualified in our forensic procedures."
As long as they were cross-trained in FOREC, the International Forensic Standard, then it shouldn't make that much difference. "Main thing I need from you guys is a review of the local satellite coverage. I want to see if we can get a track on the bandits' movements around the time all this happened. It can't hurt to check the local Hypernet listings, too. Have a look and see if anyone's trying to sell weapons or technology that looks like it belongs to our victims."
"I'll get right on it, Layton. I'll link you back when I have something."
Her face disappeared from my view. Dev and I, together with Captain Phillips, walked into the smoky, gutted shell of the hospital.
In the reception area, a malfunctioning hologram flickered, showing a life-sized, dark-haired Karen Cole, the doctor this place was named after.
She had been the second person to set foot on Eden in the Tau Ceti star system. After returning home, she had come here to find herself and spent months working in this hellhole before setting off 35 years ago on another trip to some other star. Karen Cole was an impressive woman and a living legend.
"What do we have here, Captain? What would you expect?"
She gestured around with a gauntleted hand. "The pharmacy is cleared out. Any portable equipment of value has been taken. And the bastards ripped the implants from the people before torching the whole place." Pursing my lips, We walked through the still, smoldering building. I presume you've set up a perimeter? I have a forensics team coming in, and don't want anything disturbed more than it already has been. Already underway, Inspector? I nodded at her. She was a picture of competence, her calm authority reassuring. This is where they were locked in. Phillips pointed at a door that one of her troops had smashed off its heat-blackened hinges, in the vain hope of finding someone alive within. As we stepped inside, I could see that the fire damage had opened up the roof, and bright sunlight streamed into the interior. Charred corpses filled the room in tangled heaps. The smell of burnt flesh was nauseating. Ever since we confirmed there were no survivors, no one has been inside. Looking around the room from the door, I admired her optimism in hoping that someone had still been alive. Good work, Captain. Let's clear out and leave it for the forensics team. Phillips nodded and turned, the servos and motors of her armor quietly whirring. Together, we walked back out onto the dusty car park outside. A small chime rang in my ear, and I accepted the link. I heard Giselle's voice.
Leighton, the team from Cairo is loading up on a hypersonic bounce as we speak. They'll be down to you in a couple of hours.
Good. We should hold off on contacting families until they can confirm IDs on the bodies.
Agreed, Giselle responded. How are our Australian friends taking it?
I looked across at Phillips, her lips pressed together in a thin line, the only outward sign of a cold anger. About as well as can be expected. When we find these guys, I suspect they're going to start regretting their choice of career real quick.
Yeah, well, I've just heard. Canberra has cut Captain Phillips her orders. She has carte blanche to go after them. The Aussies are going unilateral. They want scalps and don't care who they piss off getting them.
Phillips had moved away from us, her head cocked in that way many people did when they listened in on their link implants.
Yeah, looks like she's getting the news now, I said.
See what you can do about getting that sat track done.
Closing the link, I turned and walked back to our VTOL aircraft.
It was sleek and black with its camouflage armor deactivated. Because of its vertical takeoff and landing capabilities, it was well suited to these kinds of third world environments.
It could come and go just about anywhere, whether from an airport or in a desert.
Captain Phillips had done a good job of making sure that no one could get near the hospital. While Dev and I busied ourselves in the VTOL, making a hell of a lot of links, we had a lot of things to sort out.
Everything from ensuring that the bodies would get repatriated as soon as possible, to making sure that my investigation log was updated with our every action.
Hopefully, we would catch the bad guys who did this at some point, and put them before a tribunal. Every I needed to be dotted, and every T crossed. I heard the chime of a priority link, and my boss's ID appeared on my HUD. What's up, Giselle?
We've got something from the sat track on these shits.
We think we have one of them. Now that piqued my interest. Every inch of Earth's surface was monitored by satellites 24/7, but it was mostly a passive thing. The satellites watched, but no one watched the watchers. Giselle had had her staff going through who had what orbiting over Sahelia at the time we knew the hospital had been torched, around 2 days ago. Then, getting warrants to access the satellite archives. An image appeared in my eyes as I accepted a request to share information from Giselle.
We've managed to track the group. They used 4 vehicles, minibuses of some description by the look of them. 20 bandits in total. They did what they did, and then hauled us back to Air Rahad, a town about 15 miles due west of your current position.
You managed to keep them tagged?
Carry on watching. See the guy with the god-awful mohawk? Keep an eye on him.
I focused on the image, the rest of the world fading from my perception. A circle appeared around the man, a strip of black hair visible on his otherwise bald head.
They head into Eir Ahad, Giselle continued. I'm presuming these shits have some kind of awareness of satraks, since they drive to the local bazaar, ditch the vehicles, and get undercover. The majority of them seem to have changed clothes, and I lose them all except for Mohawk. This guy clearly doesn't like a hat messing with his hairdo. I watched as Mohawk made his way out from under the cover of a market stall, walked along a bustling street, and entered a building. That seems to be where he's staying for the time being. It's some kind of boarding house. He's in and out of there over the last day. Possibly he's the group's fixer. He's inside now. On the map, a ping showed his location. Places like Eir Ahad didn't exactly have street names. Thanks, boss. We're going to go get him. I turned to Dev, the real world bleeding back into my awareness. The wheels are in motion, my friend. You up for this? Dev looked through the VTOL's window at the smoldering wreckage of the hospital. Damn right I am. Chapter 2. Eir Ahad. Captain Phillips had brought with her a team of enhanced soldiers from the Australian Second Commando, a hardened bunch who had fought in every major conflict, from the three Gulf Wars through the Second Korean and onto the Siberian crisis.
They were not a bunch to be messed with.
They had a lot of skills, counterinsurgency, high-tech operations, and the like. But there were still only 9 of them, including the captain herself. To make up numbers, we had met up with another contingent from the International Peacekeeping Force. These were from the Congolese Defense Force and were led by a Captain Otanga, a bear of a man who had a voice with a deep, rumbling resonance that was felt as much as heard. The CDF unit had a technical support element attached to it. They didn't exactly have cutting-edge equipment, but more than enough to do this job. We were packed into the company's armored command carrier, sweat pouring off us even though dusk was falling. They seriously needed to top up the aircon on this thing. I watched the main screen as one of Otanga's men deftly controlled a Mosquito, a tiny recon drone made up to look like its namesake. It was an odd experience. Everyone and everything seemed massive on the screen. Doors were monolithic, moving buildings, and the odd person still on the street, a gargantuan giant. Flying in through an open window of the building, we saw that we were in some kind of dingy hotel bar, although, like everything in this war-torn country, that name was generous. It was a dive. Low lights, lots of ugly chaps lounging around with prostitutes draped over them. Some of them were not even wanting to go somewhere private to earn their keep.
There he is, Otanga said, pointing at the screen.
Sure enough, Mohawk was reclining in a seat, feeling the need to wear sunglasses even in the dark room. He cut an imposing figure, a vest top showing off heavily muscled arms, a bullet dangling from a necklace, and lots of scars. Back home, he'd be a total fashion victim. In a place like this, where intimidation was the main currency, he was a rich man. The Mosquito settled down next to him, just as a gaunt, drug-ravaged woman sat up from under the table, wiping her mouth. He's a classy bastard, I muttered, as he threw the hooker's money on the floor. She scrambled to pick it up, as he swiftly knocked back whatever he was drinking in a single gulp. Standing, he zipped himself up and made his way to the stairs. Follow him. The Mosquito lifted off and tracked Mohawk as he trudged up the steps and walked down the filthy corridor to a door. The Mosquito managed to dart inside with him just before he slammed it shut. The room was as squalid as the rest of the place. Stained sheets, piles of dirty clothes, and just to complete the look, a rifle leaning against the wall, an AK-86S. The damn thing was probably 100 years old, but they were cheap, and you could buy them almost anywhere. Mohawk stretched his arms out and gave a gaping yawn before turning and looking straight at the Mosquito.
With a speed that belied a steroidal size, he slapped it out of the air. The drone spiraled to the floor, the room spinning dizzyingly on the screen before it hit the deck. The corporal, controlling the mosquito, tried to get it flying again. He managed to hop it around till it was looking at Mohawk, who was staring at his hand in confusion. He seemed to have realized that what he'd hit was not the soft body of an insect, but something more solid. A massive knee planted itself down in front of the camera. And again, the view twisted sickeningly as he lifted it up between his finger and thumb. We were treated to a close-up of a bloodshot eye, dilated with some kind of narcotic. Seconds later, the mosquito was under his boot heel. We'd been made. Chapter 3, Er Rahad. We pulled our tactical helmets on. My HUD interfaced with the opaque visor, which allowed me to see the world through the solid battle steel. Dev slid the carrier door open and jumped out. As I followed close behind, I sensed that Phillips was on our heels. Just as we jogged into view of the hotel, I saw a figure crash out of a window and onto a neighboring rooftop. "Get more mosquitoes up!" I shouted into the comm as we began running along the street, parallel to where Mohawk was parkouring. The guy was fast and had scant regard for his own safety as he ran across the shanty building rooftops. Phillips, behind me, was wearing military-grade battle armor and wasn't as quick as Dev and me in our Peacekeeper scout suits, which were Hague standard issue for deployment. It was still protective. It just didn't come with all the bells and whistles that Phillips did. I drew my sidearm, a Viking 20 Dual, and set it to incapacitation rounds, or incaps. I sighted toward Mohawk as he ran, my eye implants automatically interfacing with the gun. I led him with my aim and squeezed the trigger, just as he vaulted over a low rooftop wall out of sight. A blue flash sparked on the wall. "Damn," I muttered, a clean miss. My HUD tactical map showed an alley where Mohawk must have landed. Dev sprinted ahead of me to its mouth between two decrepit buildings. I heard trash bins being knocked over as I got to the dark entrance. A stream of bullets hissed by. I slammed against the wall, taking cover. Dev did the same on the other side. "You okay?" I called to my partner. "Yeah," he answered, his own sidearm out and pointed down. Swapping my gun to my left hand, I eased it round the corner and used my HUD to interface with the camera on the barrel. Mohawk was climbing over a fence at the end of the alley. "Otanga, where are your men? We were supposed to have this place locked down."
"It's a rabbit, Warren," his voice came over my link. "I'm sending my men to head him off. The mosquito is heading for you."
I looked back and saw Phillips running up the street, still some distance behind. Her suit was more like a personal tank than our own more agile kit.
"Let's go," Dev said, setting off down the alley. I dashed after him.
Dev vaulted the fence like an Olympic athlete. I hauled myself over and crashed down on the other side. A snarling dog turned from snapping at my partner's heels and charged at me. I scrambled back. The beast reached the end of its chain and was yanked back, barking and drooling in fury. "Christ, I hate dogs. Idiot," I thought, as I remembered that I was wearing scout armor. Let the bloody mutt break his teeth on my leg if he wants to. Still, I skirted it a little wider than I had to. By the time I started running after Dev, Mohawk had charged out of the alley and turned right. Dev was hot on his heels. I heard an almighty crash behind me, and I glanced back. Phillips had decided to take the less subtle approach of charging through the fence, an easy task for someone in servo-assisted battle armor. Even the dog knew better than to give her any grief. It backed away, whimpering. As I rounded the corner after Mohawk, he turned and gave a wild burst of gunfire at us. He hit, pot luck. A round smashed into my chest, knocking me on my ass. It had no chance of penetrating my peacekeeper armor.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?